All right, welcome back to another masterclass here on the Flip Empire Show, episode 442.
Welcome to the Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
Before we dive into today's masterclass expert interview, I want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Ascend, our in-house assembly of success-minded people, business owners, and entrepreneurs actively collaborating together to ascend our businesses to new heights while also experiencing truly happier, more fulfilling lives at the same time. We believe it's not an either-or, but you can truly have both and. It's the unique and rare combination of mastermind coaching and community that makes Ascend so special. But it's definitely not for everyone. If you're an entrepreneur who's looking for more than your typical mastermind or coaching, and you think these things can help you accelerate your ascension from where you are today to where you want to go while living a more meaningful and rewarding life in the process, then you can head over to ascendyoursuccess.com, click the application button, and we'll go from there. What's going on, my friends? This is Alex Pardo, and I got another awesome masterclass for you here with Nathan Trunfeel. And guys, this dude is an absolute stud, rock star, 33 years old, and is the president of DLP in their lending division. This is a company that owns over 10,000 multifamily doors and provides any type of financing and lending across all spectrums of real estate, from single family to multifamily. They handle fix and flip, new construction, bridge loans for multifamily and single family across 30 states. He's also an active real estate investor himself. He's the host of the Talking Loudly podcast with Nate, and just a quality dude, somebody who is very driven, very ambitious, and has quickly risen up the ranks, and it just comes with a wealth of knowledge and experience. And on this particular podcast, you know, we talk about what got him to the top, right? And so he talks about his personal development journey and how he sharpened his axe as a leader, what some of the challenges are. You know, ever since 2017, the company that he's now the president of, DLP Lending, has doubled in revenue, over $700 million in originations. And their staff has grown from 16 to 34, so more than double. And he's responsible for a big part of that with his team. And so he talks about leadership challenges and how to manage, how to hold people accountable. We talk about the lending, the current lending environment. And we also spend a lot of time talking about, you know, transitioning from single family to multifamily. What are the biggest mistakes and pitfalls that he sees people making that are transitioning from single family to multifamily? Should you, if you're looking to transition into multifamily, should you go after the big 100 plus unit deals, or should you look at smaller, like 10, 12, 20 unit buildings before you jump? You know, his answer might surprise you. So there's a lot we talk about in this podcast, and just somebody that, like I said, just has so much experience, so much knowledge, anything and everything as it relates to lending, and is just an expert when it comes to real estate investing in general. So let's dive into this masterclass with Nate Trunfeel. Nate, my man, how are you, buddy?
Oh, Alex, I'm doing great, feeling blessed, man. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, I have been looking forward to this one. Guys, you are in for a treat here with this masterclass, because Nate is an absolute stud, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, brother, but your resume is impressive. So to give people some context, I first met Nate in September of last year, so 2019. Nate recently joined the mastermind I've been a part of for 3 years, and he and his partners, I mean, you guys are just rock stars, man. You guys are studs. You have been involved in this business for 10 plus years on the lending side, on the acquisition side. I mean, I think from operations to lending and everything in between, dude, you bring so much perspective, experience, and insight to the podcast. So I'm excited to dive in, dude.
Absolutely. Thank you for that more than warm welcome. And I'll definitely make sure to exemplify the fact that it's a team effort. By all means, you know, I am in charge with leading and running the lending company. sit on the executive team of DLP Real Estate Capital, which we're very vertically integrated with a lot of different real estate investment focuses and have been doing it for quite some time. So excited to dig in, man.
Yeah, brother. Yeah. So why don't we kind of, let's take a few steps back. How did you even get involved in real estate? What year did you get involved?
Sure.
Talk to me a little bit about, because from getting to know you and just some of the conversations, I can tell you're super passionate. You're super driven. So I want to kind of figure out what makes you tick and how you even like got your start in real estate. And we'll go from there.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely, man. I will say first and foremost, like, passion and driven, you know, grit, pig-headed discipline, determination, like that is really it. There's no real secret sauce. It's just hard work over and over again, but making sure you know what your purpose and your why is. And that's really what's sort of gotten me to where I'm at in my career. A lot of my experience has been on the finance side. So I graduated college in 2009. It wasn't necessarily the easiest job market, but took a job at a residential mortgage company. So did all that fun Fannie, Freddie, FHA, VA type of lending, loans, refis, purchases for the first 5 years of my career. And during that, got an appetite in real estate. So I've done, have done a good handful of deals myself on the side, but always sort of on the side with my core focus being in lending. And throughout that, really just continue to move through the different milestones of my career and different management opportunities. Was first producing in sales, then sales producing manager, then management only, then directorship roles over, just sales, over just operations. And now at DLP here, president of the company and sort of overseeing everything in between sales, operations, credit decisioning, marketing. And then the best part for me is, more being able to have access to more hands-on investing, because DLP Real Estate Capital is an operator by trade. We own about 10,000 doors, multifamily. We still do a little bit of single family fix and flip. We more so on the single family side, build to sell, build to rent, a little bit of both in Central Florida. And so that's sort of it, the short version of it. But again, it's all just based on hard work, discipline. I really like to be a master of my craft as best as possible, which just means collaborating with great minds like you in mastermind groups. I always call it my second shift, like late night hours, just studying and reading. I sort of save all of my absorbing and learning of different industries and segments for the nighttime. And that sort of forward thinking and if you're not growing and learning, you're dying type of mentality is sort of what's gotten me to where I'm at.
Would you say, Nate, because you and I were just talking off air, 33 years old, I didn't realize you were that young, and now you're president of an Inc. 5000 company, one of the fastest growing companies under your leadership. I read in 2017, you guys have doubled now in revenue since you've come on board. And to your credit, man, obviously that's not all on you. That it requires a team effort, but you're at the helm. You're leading the team. And so, what would you say? Did you kind of touch on what that's been one of the biggest keys to your success and how you've been able to rise so quickly? And now you're president of a very large company that, 10,000 doors owned, and you guys just cover the gamut, brother. What would you say has been the biggest key to your success? Has it been the personal development and the work you've put in?
I would say absolutely yes. First off, is that you hit the nail on the head, is just the focus on personal development. But more importantly than that, understanding myself in my own personal development, mainly so that I can work to impact others. Because the most important, yet the hardest part of growing any business, it's not the like buying and selling of real estate, writing of loans and making revenue. It's people. It brings me the biggest joys, unfortunately, the biggest frustrations at some points in time. Not only just looking to develop myself, but attempting to develop myself as a leader, whether that's in a management realm or a true leadership role, is really been most important. Finding out how to build relationships, how do you hold people accountable and walk that fine line of coming down too hard but not hard enough, and helping develop people, let them learn by failure, but then also, learn by guidance. That's been really what's allowed me to move in my career. And honestly, again, I started as just a sales producer and knew that I could always just grind it out. Mm-hmm. Sell whatever you give me, I'll go out and sell it. Mm-hmm. And it's not about selling, it's about getting people to buy, but that's a whole different conversation we could have. And then just moving up towards progressing and managing more and more people. What's most exciting outside of, I will tout it really quick, joined DLP in 2017, lending company. We've more than doubled our loan origination, which also means we doubled our revenue every single year, mm-hmm. 2017 to 18, 18 to 19, 19 to 20 now. On pace to do it again. We had a little setback with COVID. But just as importantly, I was just looking at this recently. When I came aboard at DLP, we were 16 people. And you think about like where we're at as a company, the processes or lack thereof that we had. And now we're 34 FTE full-time employees. So more than doubled the amount of people while doing it. And that has been, you know, like the biggest focus. It's why I do it, is for people and providing impact on people. Like I said, it's the most important, but many times the most difficult part of growing any sort of organization.
Yeah. What would you say has been the biggest challenging? Because you just said you guys have doubled in staff. You talk about the importance of having the right people, how much time you've spent on the leadership side of things. What would you say over the course, when you look back the last 12, 24 months, you guys have had like, you know, you've doubled in growth, you've doubled in staff. What would you say has been the biggest challenge and learning lesson having gone through that?
Yeah, man, that's a great question. Certainly a tough one at that. I guess if I'm going to be really candid, I think what I've learned is, I hold myself to certain standards, extremely high ones at that. And to me, that's what it's allowed me to be so-called successful in my career. But the way that you manage yourself and push yourself, hold yourself accountable, set expectations mm-hmm. for yourself, doesn't always translate to what you can do for, let's call it, your people or the people on your team. And so just finding the fine line of like, okay, what's the right way for me to motivate myself, but yet also what's the right way to do it to a group of peers that are not like me or somewhat right. like me? To be very frank and honest, I mean, that's been one of the hardest things. I mean, I tend to be critical. You might say I look at I'm not a negative person in the effect of like the glass is half empty and the world's going to end, mm-hmm. but I do always look to identify problems and issues. We're big on the concept of IDS, of finding issues, discussing them and solving them. I don't like to let stones unturned, mm-hmm. And I don't like to let issues linger. So when you sort of hit head on into that, work through issues and try to find solutions as a result of it, it keeps pushing people. And again, sort of figuring out that right balance and how to relay it to a group, a growing team, is what's honestly been difficult. But at the same time, that continuous grind, that continuous grit, that continuous setting of expectations and holding people accountable is what allows us as a unit to continue to set the bar higher. And yeah. I'll say, you know, our CEO and founder, Don Wenner, does the same thing with me. Mm-hmm. It's always like, oh, we got this great accomplishment. We were X percent more in loan origination revenue or funding this month or this quarter or the last. And then it's like, okay, great. Now we got to get to here. And it's like, all right, let's go. And so to me, I know how to do that, but to get that to relate through to everybody, because there's frontline employees, middle management, senior management, all amongst the ranks, is important. So that is the very candid sort of where I'm at in my management career, leadership career, and what's been successful, but yet the biggest challenge.
And I love the fact that you said, because you know, leadership, what's that saying? A snake rattles from the head first, you know, and Don sets the tone right, and it trickles down to you. And so Don, I'm sure, sets himself at a very high standard. He holds himself accountable. A mentor of mine years ago, I was having trouble with staff and motivating them and leading them and holding them accountable. And I asked this particular mentor, I said, how do you hold your people accountable? And I'll never forget what he told me, Nate. He goes, hire people that hold themselves accountable. You know, and you have to set the tone and you have to set the standard, hold yourself, and then it'll kind of trickle down. And so I love the fact that you said that. One question I do have for you, and this is something, to be quite frank, you know, I've struggled with this from time to time. What's the balance in your mind, Nate, between like celebrating the wins and not getting complacent and just allowing yourself to accept that standard? You know, you talked about, hey, you hit this milestone and then Don is pushing for more and pushing for more. And then you're pushing your team. Like, where's that fine line between like enjoying the success and the culmination of all the hard work versus like, hey, okay, we hit that, we'll enjoy it like briefly, but time to set a new standard?
I honestly, like, just based on what I explained from my mentality, I might not even be the best person to ask, because there's a saying in the mortgage industry and financing is that, you know, you're only as good as your last month. Mm. And, you know, the clock, we're shooting this here at the end of June, the clock's about to turn to July. And, you know, great, this party is over, we got to do it all over again and then some. So it's hard, I'll say that. But to specifically give guidance from my perspective on the question is, I'm committing to bringing up the positive. And, you know, if you follow any of the EOS type of stuff in like level 10 meetings, if, yep, for those that follow that, you know, the first part of almost any and every level 10 meeting is successes.
Good news.
Getting people to talk about it, talking about it yourself. And, you know, that's to me of utmost importance, is building this cadence to where there is that positivity or the focus on the successes. And then I think you got to understand who you're relaying the message to. Mm-hmm. Some people want to be congratulated in a group setting because they want that recognition, you know, and appreciation for that matter, which is the number one reason why people are disengaged in the workplace, is because they do not feel engaged, and mainly because of lack of appreciation. And so bringing that up in a group setting is really impactful to a lot, but then also doing it on a one-on-one basis. You know, and so I'm always personally looking at celebrating a success and then using that as sort of the kickstart, the motivation to then say, okay, where do I want to go next? Yeah. And so that's just my inner working. I don't know if that relates or is great advice for everybody, but at the core of it, at the very least, keeping the successes and the positives in the forefront. You know, when we structure our level 10 meetings, we literally have the successes section in there, so you can't skip over it. And then it forces you to bring something forward in that time, or at least think about it.
Yeah. And for those of you who are not too sure what level 10 meetings, I highly recommend you guys pick up and read the book Traction by Gino Wickman. We implemented it in our business at the beginning of 2018, hired an implementer, went through that entire process. And it's a phenomenal book. Scaling Up is kind of another version of that.
Yes.
By Vern Harnish. So two fantastic, fantastic books, but you should have some sort of operating system. EOS is not the only one, but it's a pretty popular one. And Nate, I love the fact, brother, that you brought up, you know, and you didn't say this in so many words, but you kind of did, where I don't know that the same management style works on everyone, because people are motivated by different things, and you got to know your team, you got to know your staff. And for some people, they need public recognition, right? And for others, it might be more, you know, financial based, where that's how they're really incentivized. So I just want to kind of piggyback and highlight the fact that this may sound obvious, but you have to take the time to get to know your team members and get to know what really drives them. And then you can use that in your leadership. And without having that, it's going to be hard to really get everybody on board. And if they're not on board, good luck trying to grow and scale the business.
I'd love to touch on that. I mean, because I just hands down am in 1,000% agreement. And like from a leadership management perspective, like, I mean, it's crazy to think this, but like just monthly reviews, whether you do them, like we'll do them in a couple of different fashions, depending on the role. Like my salespeople, we do performance reviews every month because it's a very production-based role. Right. So we keep their numbers in front of them, their areas of improvement, their areas of weakness. And then we, you know, talk about setting goals for the future, what their goals were and so on and so forth. With our operations people, we don't always do performance reviews because it's a little harder sometimes to you know, bring that up, as well as we're just doing it more in huddles. But the most important thing is, like you said, just that communication, building relationship, understanding what they're focused on, where their areas of improvement are, where they want to improve, where they want to go. I just had a conversation with one of my managers recently, is that not all of our staff wants to like continue to move up and continue to be pushed. Some of them are happy sort of, you know, being complacent. And to some extent that can be okay in the right scenario. But at the end of the day, you know, getting to know each and every person. And then from a management perspective, like think about it. It's one meeting, one day for maybe an hour out of every month. I mean, it's 12 hours a year for one specific report. Now, you're usually doing a lot more than that. With all my managers, you know, we do weekly status calls and sort of weekly alignment meetings. But it's just that committed time to understanding who somebody is You know, people have a negative connotation in sales, but it's also like sales. It's understanding what people want, what people need, and then showing value and appreciation and care. So I know I went off a little bit there, but the importance of doing, getting to know your people, having one-on-one time with them, giving an opportunity for them to critique you, you to provide feedback to them. To me, that's a huge part of management and accountability for that matter.
Completely agree with you, Nate. Before I transition from, there's a lot of real estate investors, specifically in single family space, that listen to the show. And I want to talk to you and ask you some questions about transitioning from single family to multifamily. Because obviously you got a ton of experience there. Before I do this, I kind of want to put a bow on the leadership part of the conversation and the podcast. What are some leadership resources, whether it's books, podcasts, events, Any resources that you can plug if somebody's listening to this and understands the importance of growing as a leader and developing themselves in that area? Is there anything that you have found to be super helpful in your growth?
So I'm pulling up my Audible right now because I'm a big Audible guy. I like to say I read a lot, but I cheat and listen. but I do a lot of leadership and management type books. The Book of Leadership Wisdom is just one of the ones I've recently been doing. Let's see here. I don't have anything great answers for you right now, to be honest. I wish I was a little bit more prepared. I will say Chief Leadership Officer is a great book that I've done, recently. Scrolling really quick, and a lot of mine are self-development. Not Taught, What It Takes to Be Taught is a big one. Great by Choice. All the Jim Collins stuff is big. It just depends on if you're looking for leadership or more like scaling a company. Yep. Long Distance Leader is a very, very relevant book right now, especially with more people managing in virtual environments. So I highly encourage that one. I've been fortunate enough when I was a part of some, I'm part of a pretty big company, but larger companies have gone through some formal management training. And you know, what I tell is, as much as I probably butchered a little bit of the suggestions there, I will tell you, if you're looking to grow as a manager and a leader, you're only going to get out what you put in. Mm-hmm. So when you're given the opportunities by others, or you're part of a mastermind group that's focused on, you know, finding deals and acquisitions and sales, but yet they talk about some leadership stuff, you got to commit to it. If your employer gives you a leadership management class, pay attention, put everything else down. But again, you're only going to get out what you put in. And that certainly goes for management and leadership.
Yeah, no, and thank you for plugging those, because you actually mentioned two books that I have not read before. So I'm glad you did. The other two that I'll add in there, it's an oldie but a goodie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, everybody's probably heard that book. A great book. And then just commit to understand psychology. I love the book Persuasion by Robert Cialdini.
Love it. Classics. Those are classics, man.
Dude, I know they're. I think yours are much better suggestions because they're books I hadn't heard of, which I'm sure they're awesome. But yeah, those two classics, I mean, you can't go wrong. Those are the ones that you kind of put on repeat once a year.
So I think we would be upset if we didn't bring up a John Maxwell book either. So The Five Levels of Leadership. I'm not going to say that's a super like exciting book by any means, but. It is like, wow, information packed. And it really helps you understand that there are so many different levels of leaders. And it really is the best way that it chunks out what the mindset is of a, let's just call it, inexperienced leader, a lower level leader, to what they call a level five leader, is hence the five levels of leadership. So that is one that is a must read and a classic at that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point, brother, as with anything in life, what you put into it's what you're going to get out of it. It starts by having a commitment to that particular, like, you have to focus on that area. You're not just going to wake up and be a better leader. You got to practice, you got to work at it, and take advantage of the opportunities you get, to Nate's point. Transitioning from single family to multifamily. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, man, but I feel like over the course of the last 3 years, I mean, multifamily has been around forever. But maybe it's just kind of hit my reticular activating system. But over the course of the last 3 years, it feels like everybody is rushing to get into multifamily. Am I wrong when I say that? How are you seeing things from your perspective?
No, you're not wrong, my friend. It is. It's like it's an ageless asset class, mm-hmm. that's been a consistent performer as well. But it's gotten a lot of hype. I mean, look, let's put this in perspective too. One reason why, you know, especially real estate investors might feel like it's more of a hot topic now, is that just real estate investing as a whole has significantly grown over the last 10 years, as far as it being like an adopted, accepted, you know, line of work that is almost commercialized at this point. I mean, if you just want to look at how many HGTV shows dropped on real estate investing in the last 3 to 5 years, you'll see the numbers there. If you look at CoreLogic did a study quite about a year ago that I read that said the amount of assets bought by corporations in the mid 2000s was, I won't even throw the percent out, but then in the last year, it's about four times higher, meaning that there's four more entities or types of entities, investors that have gone and filed for entities that are buying assets. And so there's just a lot more people in real estate investing, whereas before it wasn't so much, especially as you come out of the so-called great financial crisis and crash, mm-hmm. Where people were scared to throw any money into real estate at that point in time either. So yeah. I think that's it. And then if you look at just the basic fundamentals of like supply and demand, you know, I think that'll speak to why there's a lot of eyes on it and the continuous need for housing in form of rentership, especially affordable housing and affordable rents. There's such a high demand for it, whether it's pre-COVID, post-COVID, or anything. So, I mean, no, man, I know I went off a little bit there, but you're not seeing anything that I haven't seen. I will say that it's caused some potentially deemed negative effects for sort of the grandfathers that have been in it for a while. They use an F word, not the one you might be immediately thinking of when describing it, and calling multifamily investing pretty frothy right now, you know, as cap rates have continued to come down. And essentially, you know, what that means is that people are just willing to pay more for the same product than what it used to be. And that also speaks directly to the fact that it feels like there's a lot more focus on it. And it's absolutely the case.
So for people listening to this, Nate, that have a successful single family business, you know, but single family, generally speaking, it's especially the wholesalers, the fix and flippers, as you know, it's a transactional business. And sometimes it can feel like you're in a hamster wheel and you're chasing deal, and you're making a lot of money, but you're not necessarily building wealth. And in some aspects of single family investing, as you know, there's not the cash flow component. What are your thoughts or what advice would you have for people listening to this that are tired of that hamster wheel and they want to get involved in bigger deals like multifamily? What advice would you have for them that, you know, keep in mind, and I'm prefacing it by saying they have an active, successful single family business. So sure. What are your thoughts there? Because I've seen, I'll just share with you and then I'll shut up. I've seen people that have successful single family businesses transition to multifamily and burn and fail. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then they've let their eye off the ball of what was actually putting food on the table for them. And then I've seen the opposite. I've seen those that have successfully transitioned. So I want to kind of speak to that due to the fact that there's so much hype around multifamily.
Yeah. So, you know, I won't go far down this road, but it's sort of the same thing of you have to know what your passion and purpose is and why you want to do it and then stay committed to it, right? So that's sort of obvious, but I think to preface what I'll transition into was more of the specifics. I mean, you get a lot of people that multifamily are buying a 50 unit, 20 unit, 12 unit is just the new shiny object, and they don't commit to it personally. And then physically, whether it's themselves, their team, so on and so forth. So the biggest thing that I'll start to talk about, and we can go as deep as you want down the road of the specifics of transitioning from single family to multifamily from my perspective. Multifamily takes a lot more, maybe not even a lot more, but just takes a lot of discipline and diligence. So before you get started and get into it, I encourage you to just do a lot of research. And there's a lot of different places you can go for that. It depends on your type of learning, whether you want to do it in a group with other people, self-study. I mean, nowadays you can learn anything on YouTube and Google by all means. But you do need to invest yourself and be disciplined into learning multifamily itself. That will then allow you to be diligent in making decisions on it. look, it would be sort of easy to say like multifamily is perceived to be more difficult than single family. From a transactional level, it's a deal. You close it, you go through due diligence, you analyze it, due diligence, you transact and close on it, you move through a business plan, and then, you know, it's like any other deal. But there's just a lot more layers to multifamily comparative to single family. Sure. You know, and I'll leave these topics. You tell me if you want me to go down any specifically, but from a lending guy, lending is different. So completely different debt expectations, not only on the terms that you're going to get, but the requirements that are going to be had and made of you while you have that given loan, whether it's bridge or agency financing, you know, all that type of stuff. Construction management and construction itself is different from getting permits to code to having, you know, more commercial type contractors. You know, identifying and moving through the business plan on a vacant asset is mm-hmm. very different than just a one singular unit, and trying to move through a business plan that has called maybe a smaller complex of 20 units, you know, big to some, maybe small to others. But moving through a vacant asset is significantly more difficult. Acquisitions is more difficult. The due diligence is more difficult. And I'll end in sort of the areas of difficulty of saying, you know, when you look at evaluating a single family home, mm-hmm. for the most part, I mean, you can talk about selling turnkey, but for the most part, you're just looking at a sales comparison approach, right? Right. What did other comps sell for? That's what I'm going to sell for. Mm-hmm. Well, with multifamily, there is a component of sales comparison approach, but there's also a significant and predominant portion of an income-based valuation approach, correct, which takes into the rent amounts, how much rent you're going to collect, how much vacancy, bad debt you're going to encumber, how much expenses you're going to have. And at the end of the day, you know, you can make a pro forma look great. I mean, I've never seen a pro forma.
And they usually do, right?
Yeah, I've never seen a pro forma that doesn't look great. They always look awesome with high double digit returns and strong cash on cash. But the bottom line is you got to understand you have to move through all those facets of the business strategy. Yeah. And then know that the income itself, the result of the net operating income will depict what the value is. And then for when you combine the little bit of difficulty in the way that an asset is valued, it's not as easy to move through like the disposition, whether you're recapping and refinancing or selling of a multifamily asset. Okay. Because you have to show like all the financials to everybody that you took documentation of and show the improvement and the trends and da-da-da-da. So the navigating through it and exiting it isn't as simple as like, oh, I can rent it to one tenant and make this much money and yep. get this loan, or just flip it and sell it. You know, you can flip it and sell it, but there's a whole lot more. You have to go right. through all the property management, asset management, and all that type of stuff. So yeah. I know I went a little deep, scratched the surface of some stuff. Happy to circle back on any of that, but trying to paint the picture that it takes more discipline and diligence. And then I will say, this is the last thing I'll say on it before I turn it over to you, is that doesn't mean there's not great opportunity. And that doesn't mean that diligent and disciplined investors should look to continue to invest in multifamily or transition from single to multifamily. There is a ton of still good opportunity, regardless of how low cap rates are, but you just got to know what you're doing.
Yeah. And you know, one thing I'll say, if you're listening to this and you have an interest in multifamily and you want to transition, it goes without saying, you got to get educated. You know, you got to get the proper guidance, because, you know, a mistake in the multifamily world could really cost you, you know, and I'm sure Nate, you'd probably back me on that. The consequences are a little bigger than if you make a mistake on a single right. family, right? And so you got to get educated, but it's a self-awareness game too. And I think that applies to any business. Know what assets you bring to the table. And when I say assets, I'm not necessarily only talking about financial assets, but like, where's your skill set lie? Once assuming that you understand what your purpose, your cause, and your passion is, like for me, my network, my connections is an asset. Right. And so while I might not have the balance sheet that somebody else has, I can potentially add value in the form of my network and my connection. So Nate, if you could speak to a little bit about, you know, people understanding what they bring to the table, because let's assume a lot of people listening to the show that have never done a multifamily deal before, just don't have the balance sheet to be able to, how can they start to leverage the quote unquote assets and the skill sets that they have to carve out a piece of a deal versus always trying to approach it from an operator perspective?
Yeah, no, I think that's a, a great point, right? And your network is your net worth, right? Is this cliche, but big believer in that. So my advice, I'll definitely answer specifically the question, but my advice to those looking to get into multifamily is crawl before you walk, before you run. Right. So, you know, there's in anything real estate wise, people want to talk about units and volume and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, it's about profit and being successful in what you do. So if you've never done multifamily, you know, depending on the level of single family you've done, I wouldn't just say, okay, I'm going to go buy a 100 unit complex. Right. Okay. I'd start with your 10 units, your 12 units, your 20 units or something along those lines and understand what it takes to move through that asset. And then look to go upwards. And because at the same time, relating to some of your question of the network that it will allow you to do that is you will start to build that network and understand who can help you and how to find the right type of people to help you navigate your business strategy on a multifamily asset by doing that. And you're not risking a whole heck of a lot more. I've seen a lot of single family investors try to bite off more than they can chew and just jump into deals without fully understanding what went into coming to the pro forma that they had and the, you know, viability of being able to execute on that business plan.
Yeah.
Talking about how else you can get involved. Certainly, in any type of real estate, you can always find a way to be passive, but what I would encourage you is to try and find a multifamily passive investment with somebody that you're really connected with, that you know well, that will also show you the ropes and essentially just allow you to invest by just giving capital, assuming that you have it. And then we'll show you along the way. At the same time, you know, so you can invest as a limited partner or invest in a fund or just, you know, give money in some other structure to a multifamily operator or just make sure that you do align with a partner that has experience in multifamily operations. So that's certainly a little bit easier to understand when you do just a joint venture with somebody that's experienced. But you need to find your mentors. In multifamily, and there's a lot to learn through it, learn through failure. And so I definitely encourage you to expand your network, open up your eyes to who's within your network that you can sort of piggyback with and on. And don't feel bad that you're not doing it yourself. You'd rather do it right and make money rather than get yourself in a hole where you got a lot of money tied up and are at risk of losing.
1,000%. And Nate, you know, it's really interesting to hear your perspective. I personally don't think there's a right or wrong. I think it's just a different school of thought. But, you know, I've connected with people that say that have the mentality, go big or go home. It's just as much work to underwrite and do a 10 or a 20 unit deal as it is a 100 unit deal. But you actually said the exact opposite. What I heard you say anyways was understand the process, go through it, get your feet wet with a 10, 12, 20 unit deal before you start to graduate into some of the bigger ones. It was interesting to hear that. I personally don't think there's a right or wrong. I understand both schools of thought. But you know, I have spoken to people that say, if I could go back, I'd go as big as I can right out of the gate, you know? And so I'm glad to hear you kind of share the other side of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak specifically for DLP and Don and his origination to getting into multifamily was what I just advise is sort of the path that we went on. He bought some 10 and 12 units sort of by accident, and then he purposely looked for them and was buying 20 to 50 units. Sooner than later, we said, okay, well, now we can execute on all of these. We won't buy anything less than 100 units. Now our buy box is nothing less than 200 units. So to me, you know, when you hear that type of stuff, take it in perspective of where somebody might be at is that, sure, you're absolutely right that, you know, you go big or go home. But if you are learning on a $10, $20 million asset and you fail, that's a whole lot of weight coming down on you. And so, you know, take it in stride. I mean, the other thing you can do is just simply hire people that are experienced, right? If you're a single family operator, you just hire people that are experts in the multifamily space. You know, but you do need to have that experience in order to take on the larger assets. It can be done. But unfortunately, there's a lot of stories of people trying to do it without being disciplined and doing diligence and having the right partners in the deal.
Yeah, agreed. I totally understand. And Nate, I don't know about you. I tend to learn more from my losses and from other people's losses than I do from the wins and from the successes. From a lending perspective, brother, can you share what the people that have gotten into multifamily and have failed? Mm-hmm. Are there any common denominators or things that you would draw out and say, this is time and time again why I see people fail in multifamily. Anything you can share with people listening?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and great question. You know, I essentially run all of credit here at DLP, so have my eyes and hands on a lot of different files, single family or multifamily. Unfortunately, Alex, I don't have an answer that's going to be too different than what I just shared.
Okay.
But what it really is that the ones that struggle are the ones that were just too liberal, too over aggressive in their business plan. So, you know, just to touch on a couple of areas, they're assuming rents that were above already top of the market right now, or they were assuming some of their single family rental experience numbers for a multifamily unit. They're different asset classes, different tenants, can't always be achievable and obtainable. They compress the timeline that it's going to take them to move through the reposition of an asset. The other thing is, you know, you can't, it's really hard to change a tenant base, right? Like if you have a vacant asset, you can control who you put in.
Correct.
But there's that weighing of, okay, I want to get as much in rent as I can get, but I also want to make sure there's the quality of the tenant getting it. And so you don't just want to rush people in, and you also don't want to take leases on too low, especially early on, because that sets the stage. And then all of a sudden you're missing your mark on all your units by $50 and it just trickles down from there. But it all comes back to that lack of discipline, diligence up front. You know, it's just like any real estate investing is you need to be conservative when putting together a business plan and a pro forma. If you do it conservatively, sort of worst case scenario, and the worst case scenario works, but it still worked when you knew it and planned it that way, then you're going to come out on top. If you can overachieve on your business plan, then great. But, you know, just understand what the gravity of the deal is and the investment strategy is not as easy moving multiple units, moving a tenant base in quality. You know, if you're buying in a C area, that area is still going to be a C area.
Mm-hmm.
You can expect to put in A type tenants with and achieve A type rent, class A rents when you're sitting in a rough area with a lot of gang violence and prostitution and drugs and so on and so forth. Those are the deals that we see missing the mark on what their original pro forma was. So they didn't do enough diligence up front. They didn't truly understand the market, the asset, the business strategy as a whole. And then it all sort of trickled down and together. What I can say from a DLP perspective, you know, since we buy a lot of multifamily assets, we look at our loans as if we're going to buy an asset, certainly at a lower basis than the operator. But we also give a lot of feedback and resources to people that submit loans through us.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of people come to me and say, Nate, thank you for opening my eyes up to the fact that the broker's pro forma was a little bit lofty. And I see what you mean when rents are lower or where they're expecting expenses to be lower than market or occupancy higher than market, so on and so forth. So again, a little repetitive, but it's still back to that discipline and diligence and just knowing all the nuances of what goes through the investment strategy.
Yeah, no, such a good point. Like, look, if you have to manipulate the numbers in order to make the deal work, that's a red flag. You know, I mean, operate under worst case scenario, because if worst case scenario hits and it works, it works. So you don't want the stars to align in order for you to come out winning with these types of deals. Dude, since COVID hit, how have you seen, obviously we're living in a different world right now, from a lending standpoint, how have you seen things change? What are you looking at from a lender's lens that somebody listening to this can say, hey, this is how I can put myself in the best position to succeed?
Yeah. So, a lot has happened in, you know, private lending, real estate investment lending, for sure. You know, look, there's a lot of uncertainty out there in the market, and in people's lives. I think we also need to take a step back. I mean, I've seen firsthand, whether it's sort of like with our team or clients or just people, friends, family, this is getting to people's mental psyche. It's breaking people a little bit and creating and causing them to do some things and act more emotionally than they normally would. So a little bit off on a tangent, but I just hope everybody keeps that in mind, is that like this is certainly affecting a ton of people's lives, sad about the unemployment and all of the economic effects. But it's affecting people's mental psyche and place. And so we got to continue to stay strong. From a lending perspective, when things are deemed to be more risky, lenders tighten up. And that's what we've seen in almost all types of lending. What's important to note is that, you know, in the great financial crisis and the housing crash, lenders were made the scapegoat, not in a bad way, like it shouldn't have happened. They were a lot of the cause of it. But we learned from that, lenders and the credit society and industries as a whole, and we have built really good fundamentals. So now you have, you know, on the residential side, your Fannie and Freddie, mm-hmm. and also in multifamily agency, like they were built to provide a good, consistent credit analysis and liquidity to the market. So that's why lenders are still operating, is because the fundamentals of how we look at deals is a lot more diligent than it was when, you know, we were doing NINA, no income, no asset loans, and you just pick your appraisal value and that's what it is. And maybe I'll add even a couple dollars more if you want to give me $1,000 extra on the side, you know, all that crazy stuff. We know it was happening, but They put in so many different, regulations that I could, you know, rip off. And honestly, half the reason I got out of residential lending, so I don't have to memorize it all. But we've all tightened up. So from a real estate investor perspective, what you need to expect is that this is, for at least the foreseeable future, the new norm. You know, in a fix and flip loans pre-COVID, you could get something with 90%, right? 90% of purchase, 100% of renovation, or 90% of renovation and purchase price. That's not there anymore. Will it come back? I don't have a crystal ball, but I don't think it's going to come back soon from any of the large lenders out there. Okay. So what that means to you is you need to plan to have more capital invested into a given deal. You need to make sure that not only you have the money to deploy into the acquisition, but you also have enough money to navigate through the reposition if it's a renovation type of job, or you have some reserve set aside from a rental perspective just because of look at what's going on with unemployment. So lenders have deemed things risky. When they do that, they tighten up. They give lower loan amounts. That reduces their leverage. We've tightened up. A lot of lenders have tightened up their guidelines. So they look for a higher credit score because supposedly a credit score talks about repayment history and viability, more required experience. So at the end of the day, come prepared with more money. Come prepared to show further documentation of any of the deals that you've done. And just make sure you fully understand what the terms are, because they are different than pre-COVID. They are likely here to stay for at least the short term. I've been giving the analogy that we've just turned the clocks back about 5 years in the real estate investing world, because it wasn't always at 90% of purchase type financing, at 7% at one point. You know, most of the time it was, over 10 years ago, it was 65% leverage with 14% and 4 points, right? So put it all into perspective. Know that we've turned the clocks back a little bit because there's more risk out there, lower loan amounts. Lenders are also requiring more reserves, like prepaying payments up front, and guidelines are a little bit tighter. Right. So you just got to cross your T's, dot your I's, be prepared for maybe a little additional red tape and lower loan amount, a little bit higher pricing. But at the end of the day, it goes back to, you just got to have good deals. And if you have a good deal, your margins might be hit a little bit. Your cash on cash might be not as good because you have to invest more money up front. But if you're penciling it out conservatively, there's still a lot of money to make.
Yeah. Awesome, brother. Man, so much unique perspective and experience that you bring. And I feel like we could talk for hours and hours, man. And we're just kind of scratching the surface. But before we talk about, I want to talk about your podcast a little bit and how people can connect with you. This is a question I usually ask guests and friends that I have on the show here. So you're a young guy, 33 years old. Rewind the clock 10 to 13 years. Let's say you were speaking to the 20-year-old Nate. What do you know now that you wish you knew back then? And what would you share with yourself that you think can have an impact on people listening?
Yeah, that's a great question.
I know it's a general, it's a kind of a tough one because you're going in two directions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna give an answer that contradicts itself within its own with what I tell you here.
Okay.
So I wish I would have told myself is when it comes to people, be more patient. When it comes to myself, push even more and go look to do it more on your own. And without getting too deep into sort of those roads, I tend to be impatient with myself, which helps push myself. But I need to understand that that's not the case with everybody else. So seeing and having patience with other people is one thing. But then going out and doing stuff on my own more, building my own equity and taking those steps earlier in life is what I wish I would have done earlier. I'm very blessed to have gone down the career path that I have, worked for some amazing people and amazing businesses. But a lot of times that was their business, right? And I didn't build that. As much as I built equity for them, it wasn't for me. And so taking that action and taking that risk in those regards, pushing myself to go out and get it for myself in some capacities is what I would have told myself. Because I look back at all the great things I feel like I've done and the people I've impacted for someone else's business, man. You know, and that's just the heart of it. That's the truth of it. I hope a lot of listeners are like, that gives them that extra confidence because they're already self-employed and doing it. You know, but that's what I would have told myself.
Yeah. Well, man, the experience and the skill set, the knowledge that you acquired along the way, while it was for somebody else's business, you probably wouldn't have been in the position you're in today without having gone through that. So yeah, there's always a silver lining, right? But that's incredible, Nate. Brother, talk to me about Talking Loudly with Nate. So fellow podcaster here, my friends, definitely check out the show. Matter of fact, I'll throw it up on the screen, talkingloudly.com. Tell me about it.
Yeah, man. So you let it off, man. I like to think of myself as a passionate person for things that I care about. When I get passionate, I start talking really loudly is what I'm told. So check out talkingloudly.com. I mean, look, I could only say and hope that it's as good and valuable a content as the Flip Empire show. But I look to bring on all real estate investors of all shapes and sizes, or vendors or service providers, people that are all in and within real estate. Some super successful, accomplished people. And we talk about life, personal development, team development, scaling businesses, executing on real estate strategies, and everything in between. I can tell you, I pride myself on providing valuable content. So there is just a lot of really good value that you can get. And I cover a whole heck of a lot as well. So check it out at talkingloudly.com. You can always find me on Facebook, Nathan Trunfio. Instagram is Talking Loudly with Nate. And then for anything lending wise, please www.dlplending.com. We lend on all things single family fix and flip, single family new construction, multifamily bridge loans. And we control our money, we control our capital, which means we can help you scale a business just like DLP's done.
Yeah. And guys, highly encourage you if you're experienced or if you're thinking of getting into this, connect with Nate and his team because they cover the gamut. Not only is Nate obviously a successful real estate investor, but he's a president. He's been involved in operations. He's been a borrower. He's a lender. So he has seen it from all different angles, and he can just be a huge member of your team if this is the direction you're looking to go in with multifamily, or if you're going to stay in single family and you just need lending and you need financing. Definitely connect with Nate. Check out his podcast, talkingloudly.com. I love the fact that you're out there putting content, man. Brother, you can tell when you connect with somebody and they're living their passion, they're living their purpose, their cause, their mission. And that's the sense I get every time I speak to you. It kind of oozes out of you and just continue to do the work you're doing. It's inspiring, you know, especially at your age. I mean, dude, you got the resume that a 63-year-old would be impressed with. So the fact that, and that's to your credit, you've done the work and you put yourself in this position, and you're obviously sharp and know what you're doing. So absolute pleasure knowing you, man, and having you on the show.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward for some reciprocation to get you on as well, man. And wow, I just can't thank you enough for what you just said there, and just know that, man, I'm here because I respect everything you do. Follow the podcast, and hopefully we'll be doing this again soon.
Yeah, I really look forward to it. My friends, highly encourage you to connect with Nate, dlplending.com for any lending finance type needs, and check out the podcast, talkingloudly.com. And you said Talking Loudly with Nate on Instagram, right?
That's it, man. I just started the gram, so I need some help. Please connect with me, Talking Loudly with Nate. I need some help. I'm behind the gun on some of this stuff. But man, I appreciate it so much, Alex.
Yeah. My pleasure, my friends. Guys, thank you so much for subscribing, for taking the time to listen to the show. This show exists because of you. This is part of my purpose and my passion is getting guys like Nate on here and delivering the highest quality content as possible. If I can answer any questions you have, if I can be a resource for you, anything I can do to help you advance, not just in your business, but in your life, even more importantly, anything I can do to help, reach out. I'm here to serve. And Nate, my brother, thank you, man. Awesome having you on. Take care, everyone.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire Show. But we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text EMPIRE to 67076 or head over to flipempire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.